and welcome to this week's Propcast. I'm Andrew Teacher. This is in association with Property Week, and we're in the Mayor's Parlour at Barkingham Dagenham Council. And it's the one and only Councillor Darren Rodwell, leader of Barkingham Dagenham Council. Darren, lovely to see you. Brilliant to be in your parlour. This is one of the best rooms I think we've ever recorded in 7 years of Propcast. It's a beautiful room. There's some bling over to my left. There's the sceptre and a load of other stuff that looks well alarmed, that cabinet. But it's a beautiful carpeted room. Lovely to record sound in. How are you?
I'm very good, and the world is good. And yeah, the mayor is pleased you're in her room while she's in Bangladesh, showing the world how great Barking and Dagenham is.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. And you and I have spoken a few times over the years, mainly at RESI conferences and other things like that, where I've had the pleasure of being on panels with you. I mean, let's get started. You're the Labour candidate for Barking in the next election for Labour Party. That was nominated in 2022. And you've been in post here for about 10 years nearly. Had a lot of interface with the property industry. And we're not just going to talk about property today, but that's a big bit of it. Housing is a large element I know that you're very passionate about. The first thing I'd like to ask you really is about conviction. It's one of the things that I think we'd all agree has been lacking in politics over the last 15 years. And when we look back on previous leaders of both Labour and the Conservative Party, whatever your politics, you'd look back on a number of them and think, actually, look, I might not have agreed with the politics of Gordon Brown, might not have agreed with the politics of John Major, but they're genuine individuals, and their conviction and their sensibility and their intellect particularly has probably outlived some of the slightly dodgy decisions they might have made. But is conviction lacking, Darren Rodwell, in today's politics?
I would say conviction isn't lacking. It's just not getting an airing. And I say that in the way that, listen, I'm a conviction politician. You won't get anyone wanting the best for their community than I. And there's two types of people in this world. There's people that believe they are made up by their community, and there's people that believe they're above their community. I'll leave that for people to decide which party both represents that. I think if you listen, and I'll say for my party, if you listen to Keir, as I have in different speeches, he's got conviction. It's how it's then portrayed. And if I then take the other side of the coin, you got John Major back in the day. And I remember spitting image showing him as a very grey, boring person.
Yeah, he sweet peas, didn't he?
Yeah. But, you know, you listen to him today and he's still very much a states person. And that's really important, because actually you then got someone like Boris Johnson, okay, Mayor of London, but as a prime minister, would you say he had conviction? Time's out for what he had.
No, he didn't have permission. I saw his Teflon Tommy. He would tell you what you wanted to hear.
But that's what's really interesting, because if you look at what's happening in America right now, again, with the Biden-Trump situation, I think they're in a more desperate situation than we are. So if, again, I look at my own party, I think there's some incredibly well-spoken, articulate, conviction politicians in the shadow cabinet. And, you know, there's one or two in the government. I only say one or two because I have to say that I've lost a lot of respect for what they have or haven't done. If I'm being honest, I think Mr. Gove probably still links into that conviction politician. I think
he's more left than most of the Labour front bench, isn't he?
I would say that he's definitely interesting, but it's whether he's able to do the job that he sees in his conviction.
Well, it's allegedly quite interesting on a night out. Well, that's something for another podcast,
again,
I think.
I have to say, like many people, I'm more interested on the internet when I read about myself or in the newspapers than I am in real life. So it's a really difficult one. Rather than me sort of saying this, that or other about a person, when I meet them, I either like them or I don't like them. It's what makes me a terrible politician, but a great community champion.
So what you're saying then for the Labour, yeah. I mean, Sir Keir is a good example. I mean, would he cut through better if he spoke like you? Or would he cut through better if he had better PR advisors?
Well, I would say what would be better for Keir, and I say this, is he shouldn't be a gooner, he should be West Ham, and I've said that to him before. But I would say you've got to be who you are, and people will see for who you are, and then you've got to make sure you have a broad church of people, because no one is perfect. It doesn't matter who you are, and you've got to look at what you stand for and then say, okay, how do I build a coalition around the values of what matter to me and the wider community that I want to represent? And I've done that here in Barking and Dagenham. if you look at this council, just over a decade ago, we were fighting the BNP. Today, we are known for transformation, inclusive growth, but more importantly, representational politics. So I've got 14 different countries in my chamber, which is an incredible situation to be in. So I've got 14 different people that didn't start out as British citizens, actually now being representatives of Barking and Dagenham residents.
Mm. Are they going to try and stop other people coming in the country like the current lot?
I think it's wrong. What puts the great in Great Britain, and I've been very clear about this, is our diversity. Mm. Ever since Roman times, we've had immigration. What we actually need to do is have the right immigration policies that work for the country. And listen, I make no bones about it. I wasn't a Brexiteer. Doing what we did there was causing ourselves a problem, and it has done, and we've seen that. It's caused a real problem. Free movement of trade is a problem, and now we're out of it. So we need to make sure that what we do is encourage the best talent we can from around the globe to make their home in the UK.
But there's a conflict to that, isn't it? Barking and Dagenham being a great example, known massively around the globe for being one of the big homes of Ford,
yes,
motor company.
Yes.
And whilst British manufacturing does seem to be clinging on, we absolutely have this conflict between seeking to protect jobs through overly protectionist immigration policies, but then forgetting that students, the financial services, all sorts of other investments that flow through Britain demand that global outlook. And then fundamental facilities, health, education, rely on having a foreign workforce, particularly take midwives in London.
Well, you take any area of global Britain, actually, we do need international investment. We do need people to come here and give us their best talent.
Don't we just need a bit more honesty from government and future government? And I think the simple point being that if we explain to people that a lot of their fears, which are very rational, actually, aren't due to immigration. And that's the broad point, right? It's people complaining about lack of social housing, lack of school places, lack of access to a GP, lack of proper hospital facilities.
So that's,
and the response is, well, that is the foreigners that have done it.
Yeah, but that's because you're going to populist politics. You're playing on people's ignorance and lack of understanding of the world around them.
Has suited politicians for the last 20 years.
Well, yeah, it has. In fact, I would say it suited politicians longer before that I was alive. If you take Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, I mean, frankly, you will always have these people that want to split society, communities. Yeah. Now, I live in the east side of London, who are very, very passionate about diversity. And we can see that when the black shirts in 36 came along through to us embarking in 210. We are very clear. Everyone should be welcome and be made to be welcome to invest in what is our community. Now, our problem is we forget that global politics has always been here. So the Becontree Estate, the largest council estate ever built in the country's history, got funded by private money because it was just after the First World War. The country was broke, so it had to go out into the marketplace and get the funding. If we wanted to do that same estate today with all the parks, all the social infrastructure of shops and jobs and all the other bits that went with it, you're talking about £20 billion, yeah? And that's why 2 years ago, I, with the private sector, started working together for Opportunity London. That's £100 billion we want to see as investment into the capital city. Not for the capital city, but actually for the UK economy. Because whether we like it or not, again, if we go back to the Romans, London has always played the major part of being the gateway either into the UK economy or out into the world economy.
So would you see a Labour government as flipping back towards a more common sense approach as far as London is concerned? And what I mean by that is that the Boris Johnson levelling up narrative, which was largely about winning long-term working class Labour seats, which he did very successfully, what that narrative essentially told everybody was, oh, don't worry about London. London's actually not that important. We really care about Humberside. You know, it sounds a bit like a Morrissey song, right? The Smiths. Panic on the Streets of London. Dublin, Dundee, Humberside. There we go. We'll talk about music in a minute, Darren.
But it's certainly not Dagenham Dave.
Dagenham Dave, yes.
By Morrissey. So look, the fact of the matter is...
National Front Disco, another one of his good songs. But I want to come back to the National Front in a second. But before...
But I wanted to answer that bit on Boris and the populism. This was still populism politics because he was going north against south, London against the rest of the UK.
But the point is that for the UK to be successful, it makes no sense to diminish London.
Agreed. But at the same time, we've also got to accept that London can also be seen as a bit elitist. So when people talk about London...
Well, it is.
Well, no, hold on.
I live in Highbury. Of course it's elitist.
Well... You live in Highbury, that's very good. But I live in Barking and Dagenham. We're a London borough since 1931 and the poorest area in the country. So let's not pretend there's one London, right?
But Darren, I grew up in Barking, so I was schooled in Ilford. So I'm familiar with the area and I've spent a lot of time
A very different area to even when you grew up.
Yeah,
right?
We
are the 10th most diverse area of the country. We've had the highest population churn anywhere in the country. We've got the youngest youth population anywhere in the country. And we are also seen under the ONS as having the highest indicators of poverty anywhere in the country. So we are a very different place to when you grew up and I grew up here. Because actually, when I grew up here, we were a very proud working class blue collar community, and for someone like me, you did well in life. For someone like me, where else am I going to work in? Was I going to work in Fords? You know, my best qualification was a CSE in car mechanics. I could strip an engine in 20 minutes, but that wasn't from school, that was from other activities, because that was the way you grew up here at that time. And that's no different to the mining towns of the north. That's no different to the valleys in Wales. Mm. What we actually need to do, and what we've started to do here in Barking and Dagenham, and I hope any Labour government moving forward, is investing back in people and showing them that there is an ability to have change and embrace that change. So we used to be known for Fords. We're now going to be known for making films. We've got the largest film studios in 25 years and another studio here as well already. And that's going to produce thousands of jobs. And it's really iconic, where I was thinking about what car was I going to be on assembly line for, or what warehouse job I was going to do, where I know my future generations in Barking and Dagenham will think about what film will they be involved in and what part of the globe will that be in. I mean, that's a very different mindset, and we need to keep pushing for that.
I want to talk about the BNP, because there was a phase, wasn't there? It was around one of the previous general elections where they were getting a lot of airtime, a lot of network news coverage, question time appearances, all of this sort of stuff. And I think for people that have just watched this on TV, it's a very different experience. I'd like to just sort of spend a few minutes talking about that.
Of course.
Because for all of the bravado that comes with politics, and you know, you're not without bravado, Darren, I think it's fair to say, but there's one thing kind of going into bat with property developers, and there's another thing going into bat with people like the BNP. What was the approach there? How did they respond to you, and how did that make you feel?
So it's really interesting, because I gave up a company that I had and started working for a charity so I could take on the fight against the BNP.
What does that mean?
Well, it was about my community. So I'm proud of where I come from. I'm proud of the way I speak. So I speak Estuary, sort of not East London, but not Essex. It's very working class, so I can be understood whether I'm here or in Blackpool, even if there's a bit of a tone difference on regional. But the language is the same, you know. And when the BNP came along, again, it was this populist politics. I remember Homes for Africans, and it was awful. And the sad part for me is I'm seeing the current government using the same sort of narrative, the Trumpism that I see today in British Homes for British Workers. It's the same language. It's not nice. It's not right, let alone nice. It's bad politics and it's worse business. So what did we do? I came together as a person who'd only lived on the Becontree estate and brought people from around the world together. And together, we started talking about our values as a community, you know? So a Savoy and chips is a very East London thing, But that comes from the slums of the old East End, when the Jewish community were very much in Whitechapel and the Eastern European communities there as well. And that was unique. But today it can be curry, right? Because the world always evolves. If you think of the Bangladeshi community, Indian community, or the Pakistani community, we always evolve and cultures always evolve. And we've got to embrace that involvement and show where our values align. And that's what we did against the BNP. Now, we were really lucky. We had an incredible woman in Margaret Hodge who was willing to articulate what we were saying on the ground. So Margaret brought me and other people together initially, but locally we were the people doing the street fights, literally sometimes. I had over a dozen death threats, and these were proper death threats. I remember at the count, someone putting a Stanley knife to my throat when I was going to the toilet. I mean, that is a bizarre situation to find yourself in. Mm. But I'm still Dagenham, I'm still working class. And I told him very clearly that he needed to cease whilst I was finishing what I needed to do. And if he didn't, maybe that knife would go somewhere else. But that's a story for another time. And that's the bravado that you need to have when you're brought up in a hard working class area. And people are very proud of their areas. And what we need to do is link that into the pride of the past, that then links into the pride of the present to build for the aspiration of the future. And that's what we've done in Barking and Dagenham. So yes, the BNP was a moment in time, but not many people talk about the fact that we brought equality to the globe. We helped stop slavery for the globe. Not many people talk about the other great people that come from this area.
How do we extrapolate some of that out of this borough to wider parts of the UK? Because one of the challenges that people seem to have is bringing that diversity to places that aren't diverse, building in places that don't want to be built upon because there's loads of heritage buildings or conservation areas, for example. How do you do that? Because there's always been that diversity here in Barking, East London, the Docklands.
There was never diversity in Barking and Dagenham. So 91% of the people that are here today did not live in this borough 20 years ago, right? Massive, as I said, 50,000 people moved out, 50,000 people moved in a 2-year period. In the last 10 years, 35,000 additional people have moved into this borough, 20,000 those being children.
That's because you've been one of the only boroughs building.
Well, there's a bit of that as well. But the truth of the matter is, though, that churn is because we were the Whitechapel of the 21st century. We were the cheapest part of London. People always gravitate to the cheapest part of London.
Yeah.
Did 100 years ago, will do today. Now, what do we need to do? We need to listen to people. We need to, first of all, apologise to people and say to them, we're sorry if what we have done as politicians has not worked for you, because it never does. And you can't keep everyone happy all of the time. There's some people that never want to see change. Yeah. And they will argue it until the cows come home. There's some people that accept that change is inevitable. And there's some people that absolutely embrace change and want to lead that change.
But the problem, I think, and certainly if we're thinking about massive issues, whether that's housing, whether that's net zero, greening the grid, all of these things are being stopped by the louder voice of people that don't like change, whether that's nuclear power stations, whether that's building housing for rent, for ownership. I mean, in Ealing, 100% affordable housing developments being refused and then turned over on appeal. I mean, it's senseless.
I agree. There are some silly situations we find ourselves in, but you shouldn't allow one person to block a whole community. Yeah, what you should do is make sure that that community has a shared value that says, whilst we respect you as an individual, we're not going to allow you to stop us moving forward. Now, I would say to you, and obviously I don't know other boroughs' details, but if you look, you couldn't have much more of a block than we had here. We had Ford that left us, and literally the whole political spiral of the BNP and all the issues around that. So what we did was we went back and we apologised. We listened to people. And I'll say this to you. I don't care where you're from on the globe. I don't care what religion, what sexuality you are. You want a place that's warm and safe. Everyone does. I don't care who you are. You want to live in a community that you can respect and they will respect you. And thirdly, you want your children to do better than you did. Now, any good politician, any person who is a community champion, who believes that they are part of their community, will know that that is what you work on first.
So why have we got such record levels of child poverty in this country now? I mean, things
at a national level, the government hasn't invested in people. There was four pillows after the Second World War that Attlee and Winston Churchill, they both agreed on. Both main parties agreed on these four pillows. The first was that we would have the biggest house building programme. They did that. Not necessarily the best quality. We're knocking a lot of it down now. But the aspiration was there to do it in the first place when they were broke. The second thing was, we're the sixth richest country in the world. Nobody should be starving in our society. So the social care system was set up. Yeah. The social security system was set up. Thirdly, people should have the right to have education to the level that works for them at no cost. So you could go to university and not have a massive debt at the end of it, because over your lifetime of work, you would pay so much more back into the state than you took out in that college or university or schooling generally. And then fourth, the NHS was formed. Now, those four pillows worked for us until the 1980s. And then those four pillows started crumbling, because people that didn't go through the war, Margaret Thatcher being one of them, forgot what those people, those men and women who saw the worst in mankind, actually then said, we want these values that give our future generations the ability to make and embrace change.
Mm. So what's the answer to that? I mean, I guess on one side, you've got the ability to conscript everybody, which might help.
No.
Possibly not so practical. Or you accept that those four areas need to be totally overhauled and reformed.
Yep.
To fit the fact that we're living in a much more troublesome era of technology and polarization, that people are living longer and are living sicker for longer, which is the crucial thing. And as you say, we haven't invested in critical issues, and we've got quite worrying trends around knife crime and youth disorder that could be quite easily sold for a little bit of investment earlier on.
But that's the whole point. So all of that stuff, when my parents were young, it was the Rockers and the Mods. When I was young, I'm trying to think, the Skinheads and the Punks. And then you had a bit of ska thrown in there for good measure. It's always going to be the same. Yeah. Youngsters need to express themselves. You know, if you look at drill music, people condemn drill music. It's not the music itself.
First of all, we close all the youth clubs.
Well, but this is the whole point, isn't it? We didn't invest again. Mm. Right. So let's go back to the four pillows.
Yeah.
We need the biggest house building program we've seen. Now, that doesn't mean it's got to be all state house building program. So if we do the build to rent market, there's £60 billion that's sitting there today that they could invest. I've been working with that part of the build family and say to them, well, you need to start building RP properties alongside everything else you're building. And they're starting to do that.
I guess one of the challenges there is, if you look at national policy on that, it sets out a 20% portion of discount market rent, which I think everyone accepts.
Yep.
But the challenge then is, that developers come to London and they've got Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London's 35% waved at them, despite construction costs hiking up, despite interest costs being 400% up on what they were 3 years ago. And these numbers don't make any sense.
They do.
Well, they don't. It's 35% of nothing. It makes no sense if you can't do anything.
Well, okay. That's because you've got the wrong business model. You got the wrong investment model.
Well, then you're not going to get your 60 billion if that's your message to build to rent investors.
No, no, no. I already am having that message. I'm having that conversation. I've got four build to rent companies in this borough alone. So if I'm doing it that bad, how comes I've built 20% of London's affordable housing? And
well, I don't think it's a criticism of Barking, Darren Rowe. No, I think it's a criticism of London.
No, it's about politicians at a national level and sometimes a regional level looking at what's working. And what's really interesting is, I agree with the mayor's policy personally, and you can factor that into a business model.
You can do, absolutely, right? You can. But if you're willing to be pragmatic on things like density and these other things, the problem occurs where councils turn around to developers and say, we want 35%, it has to be a particular strength of discount. Oh, but you can't go beyond 14 stories.
The biggest problem we've had is the lack of trust in housing. So we've had 40 years of councils being told, we didn't want you to build anything. And now actually councils, why are you not building what we tell you you need to build? Because you should build it and we're going to take planning away from you. So what we need is a brand new relationship that says, this is what is expected of local, this is what's expected at regional, and this is what's expected at national. Mm. Now, is it right that £4.2 billion was given back to the Treasury only a few weeks ago, or the £1.9 billion?
This is from housing associations, unspent. Yeah. Well, it's a factor of the fact they can't spend it because the market's gone.
No, it's because Gove could have given it to us in London. So I can tell you there's 143,000 homes that could be built with planning permissions that are there that local authorities could build today, tomorrow.
So which grant box is that?
Now, the problem you've got is they didn't put that money into London. They gave it back to the Treasury. If you look at the amount of money that the mayor gets via Homes England and that whole business, he gets 1/6 of the money of the homes that we need as London to carry on London's growth. If you then look at what we can do collectively, there is 266,000 homes that have planning permission in London today. Mm. What we need to do is work out why they're not being built out. Now, that is where we need a true public-private partnership in delivering those homes, because they should be the homes that will work for our communities.
But I think the simple response is that there's no recognition at a local political level of two things, of the national need to build homes. They'd rather appease local NIMBYs. And secondly, the fact that the dynamics of the market have shifted probably substantially since those planning consents were dished out.
And that's possible, but that's not all of them.
Well, it's not possible. I mean, it's a matter of fact. If you look at the costs of debt, you look at construction inflation.
Yeah.
I mean, Barking works because, as you said, it's cheap and you're a relatively pragmatic chap to deal with, which makes it easier. But again, we don't just need homes in Barking. We need homes in Haringey, in Ealing, in Southwark.
So, as I said, there's 266,000 homes that are there with planning permission. We need to look at why they're not being built out. And that is a joint look. So it has to be looked at by us as local authorities. Now, are they the blockers? We need to do something around that. Is it a problem at a regional level? We'd have to look at that. But is it a problem at a national? And remember, the interest rates only went up. The whole issue that we find ourselves in, the cost of living crisis, was because of what national government did some 18 months ago.
Yeah, and I think we'd agree on that. But let me ask you this, Amy. You were talking...
Well, I wanted to go back to just the point you made about local government. 1.2 million homes across the UK could be built because they've got planning permission. Why are they not being built? If you look at the local plans, over 2 million...
A lot of those consents, but let's just correct the fact, because a lot of those consents are for long-term projects that would be built out over a number of years. A lot of those homes would never be built out in a short space of time.
But they could... if the funding was there.
Well, it's not just about funding.
If you look at what happened with the Beckentry estate, in 12 years, they built 27,000 homes and all the infrastructure because it was needed. Greater London was built 100 years ago when they realised they had the slums of the old East End and other inner London issues. If we could come together with that same attitude of looking at what is the values we want to see for future generations, you wouldn't need permitted development rights. You wouldn't have the same issues. Our problem is at the moment, there is no trust in the system. The public sector at a local level finds it hard to trust any other part of government. And then you've got the issues of the private sector. You've got some very good housing developers who really want to make the right moves. Yeah. And I work with a lot of them and I talk to a lot of them. And then you got some that just want to make a quick buck.
I think that's fair.
And
I think it's about
how do we bring a new system together?
So let me ask you this then.
Yeah, go on.
So there's two questions. One, this nirvana that you've painted for us. I don't disagree with the idea. I just think it's impractical given where we are on a number of things. Principally, I mean, immigration being one, because who's going to build all this stuff? If we had the funding tomorrow to build another Beckentry, another Woodbury Down, or pick a big housing development, who's going to build it? Because we've kicked out a lot of the workers, and the leader of your party basically seems intent on pissing absolutely nobody off and on tracing the footsteps of the current omni-shambles that we have in post. And I get why he's doing that, because ultimately the best way to get elected for the Labour Party is to not reveal your hand. And that makes sense. And to some degree also, I think to what we're seeing in the States, sometimes in politics, it makes sense just to do the right things quietly And I get that. And maybe that's what he's going to do. But does there need to be, therefore, question one, a realistic and much more honest conversation on immigration? And secondly, back to your point post-war,
yeah,
do we just need to wrap a new political consensus around some of these things, housing, social care, health?
Totally.
How do we do that?
We start having grown-up politics, not playground politics. We've seen...
We've heard this before. I can't remember who said it in the Labour Party. I'm scratching my head.
Yeah, but with the greatest respect, I only say what I say. People can say what they want to say, but I've shown what you can do as a single authority with some of the biggest challenges nationally, right? No one can take that away from where we've been.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what we've actually managed to do is come out with outcomes that are second to none. I have got more children today who are going into university than ever before. I have got three universities in the borough. 97% of my schools are good to outstanding. All my primary schools are either good or outstanding.
Are they proper universities? Are they ones dishing out dodgy visas, giving people Madonna degrees?
Well, I would say if you want to say Coventry University, which is the 12th best university in the country, gives you the ability to come back and forth to university every 6 weeks at a lower price. And 57% of the people that are in that university are local women from the local area. Mm. Because actually, they're the people that were being left out in the market.
So they've got a campus in Barking.
They have. They've got our old civic centre.
Yeah.
We lease it to them. We work together with them. And in fact, we do apprenticeship degrees with them for therapists. We're talking to the NHS now about dentists. We're talking to them about doctors. So actually what we're doing is using what we can as a facilitator of the state to invest in our community. And what we're trying to do is take local people to be those people that can take our community forward.
Are we still needing to claw our way back from Tony Blair's policy of sending everyone to university?
I disagreed with Mr. Blair on two things. First of
Sir
all...
Sir Tony.
Sir Tony, if you want, right? I'm still a socialist. So I disagreed on two things with him. First of all, a bit like Thatcher, he said something which really upset me, which is, we're all middle class now. That's what his quote was.
Double-fronted Islington House.
So I turned around and said, no, I'm proud working class. I'm working class Labour, and I always been. Now, I've got a lot of respect and time for him. I think he did an amazing job overall. So that was the first thing with Mr. Blair, Sir Blair. The other thing with Tony was, I didn't agree that everyone who can be beneficial to our society needed a degree. And I often say it's not the skilled men and women that built a cathedral that had a degree, but they were still skilled. Now, the person who designed it might have a degree, but in those days they didn't. St. Paul's, none of them people had a degree, right?
The person from McKinsey that worked out how much they overspent on it, he probably had a degree.
You never know. But the truth is, though, it still took skilled men and women, yeah? And I often say to people, everyone has a place in society, no matter where their educational ability has taken them. And I say that as somebody who don't have a good degree. In fact, I do now. I have an honorary degree, but that's not the same as a degree like
in Madonna.
Wife. Yeah. So I actually have it for education, for the work we've done here in the borough. I was lucky enough. So I've got Coventry University and I've got UCL. So UCL is a pretty well-known brand globally in the borough as well, and Queen Mary's. So again, a pretty decent brand.
Mm.
So when people say to me, well, what are you doing? I can say that we're building the homes, we're making sure our children have the expertise to work globally, but also locally and for our community. And at the same time, I'm bringing investment in. So I always say in this borough, and this is what we need to do as a country, we need to listen to people. They are the aspiration. They're the people that lead their local community.
So in terms of consensus politics, if you get elected at the next election, which you obviously hope to do, who would be some of the people on the other sides that you would pick up the phone to on some of these core issues?
Oh, that's a good question. I can't tell you that because I don't know how many of them will still be there.
Well, let's assume some of the better ones are still going to be there.
All right. Look, before we met today, Sean Bailey, Lord Bailey of Paddington, is it not? Yeah.
Bailey of Marmalade.
Well, yeah. But a working class fella who actually started in youth. And whether you like him, not like
most
him.
Most of us do start in youth.
As in youth services.
Yeah, sorry.
Right? Don't be facetious. right? Cheeky bugger, right? I'm still dagging him. But he and I, whilst I would not agree with his politics, is he an okay fella? Yeah, we can chat. He understands what I'm doing here. And that's how you do it. Who else do I talk to? Steve Norris. First time I met Steve was on the film studios. So I brought in £2 billion worth of investment on a 77-acre site that's brought media, data, science and engineering. I met him through that process. Now, today, I can phone him and say, look, Steve, if I was thinking about this, what would the government say to me? What would be their view? And it's someone I can talk to. So there are two people, one who's relevant as in, you know, he's still around and doing quite a lot. And the other one who's seen quite a lot, but is still relevant. He's on the infrastructure committee for the government. So
it's a contradiction, old Norris. He was on the podcast a couple of years ago. At some level, he does speak a lot of sense. And then he goes all Brexity, but never mind.
Again, with the greatest respect, if all of what we said was the same and we agreed on everything, you wouldn't need politicians and everything would be easy to do.
It's a good point. I'm interested to talk about youth services and parenting. Yep. And also talk about some of your own experiences there in your personal world. You're a single parent household. Talk us through that. What's that been like? How did that come about?
So I'm not now, thank God. I'm married now, very happily. Well, I would say I'm happily married. Not sure about the wife. I never see her, but I'm always happy. When I was 20, I was in a relationship which was quite abusive, it was fair to say. The lady had serious mental health issues, obviously not known at the time. And it came about that my daughter lived on the Gascoigne here, one of the most notorious housing estates in outer London. Whilst I, like many young men, wanted to muck around, I realised I had a responsibility. And because of the issues her mum was going through, I had a choice. Either my daughter would have been taken into care or I had to go and try and win residency of her. So under the 1919 Children's Act, in 1991, I was the first man to be recognised under the Children's Act of Romford County Court to get residency of a child. And I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me because it made me grow up very, very quickly. It was a difficult time because at that time you couldn't get benefits. So the only thing I could do was sign on for unemployment. And I remember doing a sit-in at the unemployment centre here, actually the DSS centre here in Barking, when they were telling me they wouldn't give me any money because I wasn't looking for work. And I literally had my daughter as a baby in my arms going, how the hell am I supposed to look for work? Who's going to look after my daughter? I couldn't get a council place. This was 34 years ago. There was none to be had for someone because I could live with my parents. So none of these problems have been new. What we've done, though, is not dealt with them, and which has led us to the largest housing crisis since Charles Dickens was a social commentator. Mm. So for me, though, it's allowed me to understand how people are feeling, the challenges they do have, because I remember having to survive on, we call them daddy pizzas. And that literally was cheese on toast with a bit of mixed herb and some tomato sauce. And my daughter today, whether drunk or depressed, she'll ask for a daddy pizza because it's that time which makes her feel she was always secure. And, you know, we've got to understand so many people are hurting today. So when people say, you don't know what it's like, actually I do. I know what it feels like to feel that the state, our community, our society, our country have left you behind.
How's your daughter now when she reflects on this? What does she say?
She says, I'm always grumpy. No, she remembers those times fondly. She's now a parent of four children herself, and one of them has special needs. He's autistic nonverbal. He's a special little lad. I love him dearly. And we have him nearly, not every Sunday, but most Sundays, he will spend a couple of hours with granddad. And he has his special time, and that gives them some relief as well. And that's really important. Everything starts with family for me and the home, and then you build from there.
And how do we go about fixing some of these things? Because particularly for parents of kids that have special needs, you know, it's an utter lottery in terms of how they get support, whether schools have the right facilities, the right people. And from the staffing side of things to the training, the funding, it's a nightmare for parents.
Listen, the problem we've got in national government is they've forgotten who they serve. And funding of essential services should be set up regardless. So what is our values as a society? I talked about what they did after the war. I talked about what they did 100 years ago. But actually, we went through a pandemic that was a war with nature. And we lost a lot of people. In fact, we lost more people through the pandemics, it is said, than we lost in the Blitz in East London. And that's a massive thing. So that means every part of our community was affected by the pandemic. So we need to come together again and say, what are our values as a society? Now, I'm really pleased that in this borough, we have more inclusive schools than anywhere else in the country. That's a fact. I know that we have built more special schools than anywhere else in London, right? I know that my grandson, so the law is bizarre that up until a certain age, he couldn't be recognised for his...
That's 5 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 5 years old.
But that's a problem because people just sit in limbo for the first 5 years.
And this is the problem. So we knew what the issues were. The primary school was really good because we had a HAARP in the school, as most of our primary schools do. So that's children with special needs. They will be catered for to a level that the school can manage. And that's really difficult. So I think what the support staff did, teaching assistants, the teachers and the school did for him was above and beyond. It kept him going. But actually, we should have the right funding to recognise it from as early as possible so he gets the best future he can in the world as he understands it. And what I can say to you today is he now goes to one of those schools, special dedicated schools, and I've seen him come on leaps and bounds. I'm never going to say he's going to achieve what others can achieve, but do you know what? I can tell you that I'm as proud of him as I am my other grandchildren and my children. Because his challenges may be different, but when he does something as simple as make a noise that indicates to you that he is happy or sad, I can't tell you how much pleasure that gives me. Because my worry is, years ago, he would have been, worst case, left to die or put into some sort of asylum which said these people didn't exist. Today, though, we are at least worldly wise to know that he can have some form of interaction with wider society. And that's what we should be investing in. So I absolutely believe to my core that everyone has a value, even those that are not seen as a value.
No, it's a good philosophy. Final couple of questions. Yeah. I'm conscious I probably need to ask you some property questions.
Yeah, let's get on to property, the stuff I'm supposed to know something about.
So BeFirst, you set that up.
I did.
6 years ago?
It was.
Get my numbers right. And that, I guess, coincided with Jeremy Corbyn wanting to nationalise everything, including house building. How has that gone?
Well, I believe it's the most successful public-private partnership, as CIFA has put it.
Well, there's not many of them.
Well, there isn't, because actually we set it up right. And
sort of like saying I have the best football team in the world in claret and blue.
Well, there's three of those, but West Ham is still the best. But the truth of the matter is, though, some have come and gone. So what you've got to understand
is... Croydon being one.
Well, there's been a number. But what you've got to understand is people understanding what we are doing. So if you look at the local government sector and the regional government and national government, there's a lot of hurdles that you've got to overcome. Red tape, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, because we have to operate within a certain sphere. By bringing in effectively a private company mindset. So I look at LBBD as a PLC, but every shareholder is the resident. And my job has been to set up a company that we as shareholders can invest in. And what that's allowed us to do is bring what was an okay planning system, it weren't brilliant, to being one of the best, if not the best in the country. At the same time, it's allowed us to bring in £4 billion worth of investment of international private money into the borough with another £6 billion in train. We can see where it's going to go over the next decade or so. At the same time, we've actually built 20% of London's affordable housing. We've got another 957 properties this year, which will be built out. There's another 800 properties that will be built out next year. Again, 85% of those going to local families. Over 90% of those will be below market rent.
So what would your message be to other Labour boroughs in London, for example, that have got nowhere near your numbers, that are even well behind their own stated local plans? There are many.
I would say that what we've got to do, and I believe the shadow team are looking at this, we've got to build for Britain. We've got to look at what works.
That's a slogan.
It's a slogan with actually...
But it's a false slogan, though, because you're not going to be the ones building. It's going to be largely funded and developed by the private sector.
Let me finish. Build for Britain means all of us have a value in this, okay? It was no different to what they did when they built the Becontree Estate. It was no different to what they did after the war. The state didn't build everything when we built the Becontree. There was private housing built. There was public housing built. The same happened after the war. The same will happen this time. As I said to you earlier, build-to-rent companies, and they are companies, are realising that actually they have now got to stop the poor doors and the gated communities, and they're starting with RPs. I know that, I'm talking to them. So they are listening. We are showing them, as a local authority, how you can bring this all together. Now, I'm not saying we are the oracle, but we have shown what we can do. And I have passed that information, and I called the paper that I passed to my colleagues in Shadow Cabinet, Build for Britain. Because I believe if we really want to get this country back on its feet, it's got to start with the home. Then it's got to be inclusive growth. And that's got to be your 15-minute neighbourhood. It's got to be, no matter where you live, you have the ability to have all the amenities you need. That's no different to what they did on the Becontree Estate.
Where do you stand then on market interventions which are worrying investors? So when Labour politicians talk about rent caps, that does scare off investors that would think, hang on, I'm going to think twice about this.
So my personal, and this is my personal view, rent caps have shown not to work in both Edinburgh and Glasgow, but some could say that in Barking and Dagenham, we also have a rent control policy. Why? Because we're the biggest private landlord, as well as being the biggest council social landlord. So I have got over 2,000 homes here in the borough that start at council equivalent rent and go up to market rent and shared ownership. There's six different rent levels, okay? I can do it cheaper than the other three build-to-rent companies that are in the borough, but they still have to think about what I'm doing, and they do their rents accordingly. So is that rent control, or is that the market?
Well, no, it's not. You're allowing the market to do what it does. And I think the demand is such that there's always going to be different layers of demand. There'll be people that will pay a grey star top of the tree rent in London, as they will for Moda in Manchester. And there'll be people that can't afford that.
At the moment, we have a problem where, if we take London or anywhere else, need facilitates who gets council housing. So if you've got the greatest need, gets the council housing. The high end of buying a property is only for the richest. So it's what do we do in the middle of the 80% of everyone else?
Well, I think for me, you look at where you can use public land and public money to build council housing, and you take off some of the restrictions and stop some of the nonsense like rent caps that would enable more global investment to flow in, which it would do.
But at this moment in time, and personally, I don't disagree that rent caps are a bad thing. We've seen that in the UK.
Will the Labour Party bring them in?
I have no idea. You'd have to ask Matthew Pennycook, who is the Shadow Housing Minister, and Angela.
Now, Angela Rayner.
Yeah, Angela Rayner, who I think gets it. Because again, if you look at her background, she understands what it's like to be a person who didn't have all the chances in life, but actually has made an incredible journey to the top of her position. And actually, I think Keir, in his quiet way, has put her in charge of housing and community. I think that is a great move, because actually you've got somebody who's lived experience, knows what needs to happen to build a community. Might not need all the financial side of it. And that's where we need true partnership and we need other people to come in. And again, I'll go back to the model we've shown here. We have been cross-sector in all of our avenues here in Barking and Dagenham, and we have built communities. And that is really important. So rent control, I think, is a red herring, personally, in all of what we need to talk about. What we really need to talk about is how can we get the housing built that has already been allowed in planning terms. How can we make sure the financing of it works? And again, I can't give you my paper on Build for Britain, but I certainly gave some very detailed options. And one of those would be, and I know we're going to run out of time, but one of those options would be is, why can't our pension funds that are already there, why can't they be utilised a lot more? Because it's ridiculous to me.
It's starting to, there is pension fund money from local government going into build to rent. But again,
not enough.
But that's largely of the barriers that these guys face at planning. It's the local authority.
No, it's not. 9 out of 10 planning consents go through planning, right? Our problem is trust of infrastructure. You do not have a problem in this authority. You don't get the residents complaining because we've already had all the discussions. They can see what's going to benefit them. At the moment, though, people can't see it.
But Barking is an outlier. You know that, Darren.
But the thing is, someone's got a lead. And then others will follow, right?
But that's a conversation you need to then have with the People's Republic of Camden or your friends in Lisson's or over in Ealing, where it's just not the case. You know, and I think
Ealing's done a massively big development group of opportunities over there. Camden, Islington have a slightly different problem. You know, they're not very big places. It's already quite dense. But even saying that, as I understand it, they are still providing. If you look at King's Cross, it provided a lot of housing for people that would have been moved out otherwise. Mm. So, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be easy everywhere, but we do need to look at what are the options in place and who are the partners that will benefit from those options. Some of it will be state. Some of it will be long-term private investment.
So would you like to see a level of collaboration if Labour gets into government and you become an MP this time next year or a bit earlier? Would you foresee a Labour government working with the opposition to work also alongside institutions to try and make some of these things real?
Yes, I think that we will have grown-up politics back in this country and not the partisan populist politics that we have seen under a new government, because I think there's a lot of people that have said they're not standing again, and that will do the country a lot of good. Some have already left, which again has done the country a lot of good. And I believe Keir will be an adult and he will be practical. And I think Angela understands what needs to happen for communities. And I think that is a really good partnership. And I think, I hope that they will look at places like Barking and Dagenham, like what you've seen in Manchester or what you've seen in Wales. There are some good policies that work, and we've proven them to work with the community and with the sectors. Now, I'm not going to say it's going to happen overnight, because in 1997, we only had to fix the schools and fix the hospitals. In 2024, we've got to fix everything, because there is not a single part of the public sector that isn't broken now. And we're going to have to make some serious choices in 2024 onwards on the values that we hold dear. And I believe it will start with the home. It will be about how we want to respect each other, no matter our diversity of character. As long as you're a law-abiding, I think you will have a future in Barking and Dagenham and in the UK. And ultimately, it's about where we want to see our country moving forward.
Final anecdote before we go. So we discovered on the ride over here that Neil Young recorded the strings to Harvest.
He did.
A stone's throw from where we're sat, which is amazing. I'm a massive Neil Young fan, as many people know, but it was in Barking Assembly Hall.
It was. It's now Barking Broadway. And you haven't spoken about the Bard of Barking, obviously Billy Bragg.
Yes.
Just down the road, I I saw his brother the other week. And then we've got Sandy Shaw, a puppet on a string. She was a Dagenham girl, Kingsmill yeah. Gardens.
Yeah.
And then you've got Brian Paul and the Tremolos, Twist and Shout. That was it. He was a butcher here in Barking. Old Brian was. And then you can talk about the Roundhouse in Dagenham. You've got the Camden Roundhouse, that's new. But the original Roundhouse of Dagenham, every major band from Queen, Cream, Led Zeppelin, Chas and Day, believe it or not, they all played at the Roundhouse in Dagenham. So we've got a great musical history.
Do we need to do more to protect cultural assets?
Yes.
How does that manifest in politics? What does it mean?
I think we've got to show the value of what culture can bring. And I say that as a place that we became mechanized human beings and our culture was divided to by society and ultimately by business. Henry Ford, if you know your history, you would know that Henry Ford was a fascist. So he didn't see people as people. He saw them as a commodity. In fact, Hitler turned around and said he was the only decent American, which shows you how bad he was. And frankly, I saw that here in my community. If we go back to the very beginning of this podcast, we'd forgotten about the world around us. We'd forgotten. We didn't even see ourselves as part of London. You know, people in Barking didn't go to Dagenham and people in Dagenham didn't go to Barking. It was ridiculous.
It kind of reminds me of my teenage years working in Romford and there was a Romford Ilford.
Exactly.
Thing.
Same thing, right? Now, what we did and what
I wouldn't
we
be allowed have... back now, would I, speaking like this?
What we did and what we continue to do is we invest in every child. A child understands culture before it understands wealth. If you give child a pound note, well, there ain't a pound note anymore, but if you give them a £5 note, a baby wouldn't know a £5 note. It wouldn't make it smile. It'd just put it in its mouth probably, right? But if you give a child something that's colourful, it will smile. It will interact with that. So to me, it's about culture. So you ask the question, are these buildings important? Yes, they are. One of my biggest regrets is what we did in this borough, what didn't get bombed under the Luftwaffe, LSD in the 60s and local planning did. So lots of great buildings here were taken away and I miss those. And I hope what we've got left can be protected. And I can assure you that there's been a few where I've tried to protect them, but local protections don't give you enough to stop them from being
well. It's something I've been doing some thinking with a couple of them. So I'd love to be back in touch with you on that, because I think it's one of those issues that's not going to quite win as many votes as a campaign to build more schools, but I think it's something that's very, very important.
It is important, because I think people got to understand, again, if you forget your history, it can repeat itself. All the negativity can repeat itself. So you respect the past, but don't live in it. You find the past to inspire you to the present that gives you an aspiration for the future. And one day you need to come on a borough inclusive growth tour, because that's exactly what I do. I tell you what makes us a great place, the place that helped us stop slavery, brought equality, and of course won the World Cup for the country, going back to football. But at the same time, I'll show you how that then links into what we're doing today that inspires the future.
Well, great to see you, Darren. Always,
and you, mate.
Always a pleasure to have a chat. And thank you for being upfront, honest, and best of luck at the election. It'd be good to see you.
Well, if we lose Barking, if I am the candidate, if we lose Barking, we've just lost the Labour Party. I think I'd be a Tory equivalent in that world, that would be, because I think we're the 20th safest seat or something is Barking. But that's because of all the hard work of all the people that work with me on a daily basis.
Well, congratulations about everything you've done. And it's good to see East London blossoming, and all the best for the election. But thank you very much, Councillor Darren Rodwell, leader, Barkingham Dagenham Council. I've been Andrew Teacher. You can subscribe to Propcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts from. Do share, comment, send us some abuse, send us some suggestions. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again very, very soon. You can check out those other podcasts with Stephen Norris. If you just go and have a look on the channels, just type in Stephen Norris. You can pull it up from a couple of years back. But we'll see you again very, very soon. Take care.